May it please the court, my name is John Simpson. I represent Lexie Summers, and I would like to request 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. This is a case involving a doctor making comments to his patient, his female patient, a male doctor, telling her, using terms of endearment such as sweet pea, sweets, love, and addressing her, telling her that if she lost weight, she would look and feel sexy, describing to her and talking to her about his own sex life, saying that if his wife left him, he'd look up the nanny and have some fun, describing his sex life in terms of how he has slowed down, but he's still like a jackrabbit, and maybe that's why he has 5 kids, describing to his female patient that sex with his wife is like boarding a pirate ship. That's the conduct that the Pelley's Harrisburg Family Practice Association, which I'll refer to as HFPA, and Dr. Siptak, argue is consists of bedside manner. It's an integral part of the practice of medicine. And therefore, only a doctor can determine and assist the jury in determining whether or not that conduct violated the standard of care. And that's why, since Ms. Summers did not have a doctor identified and designated, she cannot prevail in the court granting summary judgment. Now, there are 3 reasons why expert testimony is not necessary and likely not even admissible. And I would like to start out with the first of those reasons with an apology to the court, because I did not cite it and neither did the appellees. But there is an applicable code provision. I'm not sure if the court's aware of it or not. And frankly, I wasn't even aware of it because the conduct involved seemed to me to be so outrageous and ridiculous that I couldn't imagine that there would be a law in Virginia that says that doctors should not engage in inappropriate sexual conduct with their patients. But Code Section 54.1.2915.
Where is that statute?
59.1-2915. That's in the...
In the professions?
That's right. Section. And that's the section that deals with doctors and healthcare professionals. That particular section that I just mentioned defines and describes conditions and activities under which are defined as unprofessional conduct and under which a doctor can have his medical license revoked.
But counsel, the question was not, from the trial judge's point of view on summary judgment, whether any of the conduct that's alleged actually happened, or whether or not there's some moral duty not to have engaged in it. The question is really much more narrow, which is, should this one doctor have understood and known through due diligence, looking at the charts and examining the patient's history, the peculiar vulnerabilities? And it seems as though your response to that is, well, first off, we've alleged he actually knew everything that his wife knew and everything that was collectively known in the practice. And I take it you still stand by that assertion, do you not?
I do. That's a different issue, Your Honor. There was the one that I was talking about, which had to do with whether the conduct itself violated the standard of care, and then the other that you just asked about, which is whether the duty to familiarize, whether you needed an expert on that issue. And yes, that is our position, that we did allege that Dr. Siptak and HFPA actually knew. There was no summary judgment evidence whatsoever that called that into dispute. For summary judgment purposes, the court had to consider that true.
But the practice, we denied that assignment, the writ panel denied assignment of error too, which was the inverse imputation argument,
right,
that you made.
And that argument, Your Honor, in terms of the law of the case, because of that alternative ruling. Problem with that in terms of on appeal, what this court is doing with summary judgment is taking a de novo. And if there's a part of it that is not de novo, then we're not looking at a de novo, we're dealing with a summary judgment ruling. So that argument, I don't think, holds water in the context that we're in right now, which is a summary judgment, a granting of a summary judgment, and this court takes that de novo. And this court looks at all the facts that were alleged and the record and makes its own decision.
Help me understand this. We have the husband doctor and the wife doctor. The husband doctor is before us, and the doctor's employer is before us. So vicarious liability goes upstream, but not downstream. And having denied the assignment of error that alleges imputation downstream, that is pretty much the end of it.
We did assign error to that, and because I think the court, the circuit court, was confused on that. And what we, the confusion was this, that somehow the knowledge that Dr. Neal had, who was the wife doctor, who treated my client over 17 months, saw her 11 times for serious medical complications and harms as a result of this unwanted sexual conduct. Not that knowledge was imputed down from HFPA to Dr. Sipka, but that the knowledge of Dr. Neal was imputed to HFPA, and the conduct of Dr. Sipdak was imputed also to HFPA under respondeat superior principles. Dr. Sipdak, the issue of what Dr. Sipdak knew or should have known, the problem with the summary judgment adjudication is that there was no summary judgment evidence presented by the Dr. Sipdak that called into question the allegation that he actually knew, that called into question the allegation that there were numerous references in the medical records for this patient that had he bothered to look at them, he would have known. That was not called into question. There was a mere assertion, but that's not sufficient for summary judgment adjudication.
Right, but my last question on this topic, but and I read the arguments in the trial court where you asserted that it was clear that respondeat superior in a medical malpractice context works this way, that you can have actual conduct by Dr. One imputed to the corporation and knowledge, which makes the actual conduct by Dr. One a breach of duty, imputed, and it all aggregates in the employer. I thought, well, there's conceptual trickery there going somewhere. Show me some authority, and I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, I think where there may be also confusion is that what we just talked about, the imputation of conduct and knowledge, that only applies to HFPA.
Right.
That does not. I agree with the court.
But even with
talking about Dr. Sipdak,
even with the practice,
that doesn't work for Dr. Sipdak. And what works for Dr. Sipdak, though, is that there are allegations in the complaint that he knew.
I'm with you completely on that, and I'm trying to parse the actual knowledge from the should-have-known knowledge. The should-have-known knowledge has got to follow that imputation trail, whether it's inverse or non-inverse. But the actual knowledge doesn't. And so that leads me to another question, which is, you have alleged a lot of factual statements about knowledge of the entity and both doctors in the complaint, and you did say knew or should have known. I take it you stand behind the actually knew. You've got some good faith basis for saying this one doctor, the husband doctor, actually knew that entire history of vulnerability that's been alleged. Because there's nothing in the summary judgment record that you presented that implies that you have the firepower to prove that, and I just wonder if that's really the direction you want to go.
Well, for purposes of summary judgment, and this is something that another side of the road that court did not pick up, procedurally, if all a party has to do is make an assertion, and that triggers the other party's obligation to come forward with evidence of that, then summary judgment is turned on its head. Why have trials?
No, I agree with you. I'm just questioning whether or not there's anything in this record that gives you the confidence of pressing forward with an actual knowledge case. If this court were to conclude that there's a difference between should have known and needing an expert for that and not should have known, actually knew, not needing an expert for that.
I think there's plenty of evidence from which the jury can draw an inference that he knew.
Okay.
Now, we'd like to get back to the code section just for a moment because I think it is quite important here. The particular subsection is 54.1-2915A19, and that describes as unprofessional conduct for which a doctor's license can be suspended or revoked, includes, quote, engaging at any time during the course of the practitioner and patient relationship in conduct of a sexual nature that a reasonable patient would consider lewd and offensive. Read that again. Engaging at any time during the course of the practitioner and patient relationship in conduct of a sexual nature that a reasonable patient would consider lewd and offensive. And I think it's obvious and important that it's a reasonable patient that sets the standard, not another doctor. And
well,
I also suggest,
from a big picture standpoint, your assignment of error, I mean, this is a medical malpractice action, right?
Yes, because this occurred in a context involving a healthcare professional and my client. That's right.
Okay, and so I'm trying to separate a violation of the statute that you're talking about, a breach of professional conduct, and then violating the standard of care in a malpractice situation. Those are all different. And your assignment of error actually says that the error involves no medical diagnosis or treatment.
That's right.
The error was made in the making no medical diagnosis or treatment. So how can it be a medical malpractice action if the conduct that you're complaining about involved no medical diagnosis or treatment?
Because we have a medical malpractice statute that basically says that any activity or any conduct occurring between a healthcare provider and an individual patient comes under the Medical Malpractice Act and approval. The actual conduct here, even though it did involve any sort of medical practice, it's still, because of the statute and our code provisions, is considered as a medical malpractice act. Now, I would submit that what is unprofessional conduct by
definition, and it's also violating this statute that you just referenced, is also a breach under the medical, it's also malpractice under the Medical Malpractice Act?
No, it's a little bit different point that I'm trying to make, Your Honor, and that is that what the code defines as unprofessional conduct by definition violates the standard of care. Secondly, what the public policy of Virginia has expressed in this statute is that this is a determination made by patients, not by doctors. And that makes eminent good sense. So we would suggest that there's no basis, and we never got there because we, in case never got to trial, we never filed motions in limine, but that an expert would not be allowed to testify about whether this kind of conduct violated the standard.
Counsel, do you know if there's any regulations, or I'm just reading, I pulled the code behind me, and it talks about conduct, and we have speech here, which may be a little different. Do you know of any regulations or administrative interpretations that address that particular point?
I don't know.
Okay.
Like I said earlier,
I mean, did you look, or you're not sure?
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
And I do apologize because this is something that I feel bad that I didn't pick up on earlier, bring to the court's attention earlier. But frankly, I didn't think that, for one thing, I didn't think that Judge Wilson would reverse course after denying the motion to dismiss for failure to get certification. And then I never considered that there would be a law saying something that to me was so fundamentally obvious.
Well, what do we do with that? You're the appellant, and ordinarily we don't reverse trial courts for not getting it right when the argument was not made. And arguing that there's a statutory predicate for a duty is a pretty discreet argument. It's not just a generalized point. So you realize I'm worried for you about waiver because it could very well be the whole argument's been waived by not presenting it.
Well, I would respond to that, Your Honor. I would say that we did make the argument that expert testimony is not necessary, it's not even permissible. We made the argument in the brief that this is a matter of common knowledge and experience for the lay jury to determine whether or not these kinds of statements are inappropriate and offensive in the context that they are. It's not really a standard of care issue anyway.
But I mean, the trial judge didn't read the statute, didn't interpret the statute, didn't ask the question that Justice McCullough just asked, which is there a difference between conduct and speech?
I would suggest that the statute is not bringing in a different argument. It is supplementing an argument already made. It's the law that governs all of us here in Virginia. To the extent that I didn't bring it to the court's attention earlier, I apologize for that. It just didn't occur to me that there would be a law that says that doctors should not engage in inappropriate sexual conduct with their patients.
Counsel suggests that you have a Manchester Oaks problem in that the court also ruled that you would need an expert to testify as to whether the doctor should have familiarized himself with the records, and that you don't raise that issue as an assignment of error on appeal. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's Justice Gelsing was asking a little bit about that earlier in terms of you did allege, and in terms of summary judgment procedure, has to think it's true that Dr. Sipak actually did. Secondly, the vicarious liability claim against HFPA is charged with knowledge of what Dr. Neal did and what Dr. Sipak did.
Aside from the vicarious liability, he alleged that he had an independent duty to familiarize himself with the records. The court says you need an expert to establish that you don't assign errors.
Let me address that directly then. What we did say in our brief was that we did allege that he should have known and that he knew, but that we didn't need to prove that he should have known or knew to establish liability on this claim.
I think my question is a little bit different from the vicarious liability. You have a specific allegation that he should have familiarized himself with the records, paragraph 33 of the complaint. Trial court says you need an expert to testify as to whether a doctor who's treating someone for high blood pressure should have familiarized him or herself with the record with regard to the underlying emotional disturbances. Court says you needed an expert, summary judgment on that. Counsel says that game over, there's an alternate ruling, we don't get to go back on the other. What's your response?
Let us say where that's wrong. We're not talking about high blood pressure. We're talking about sexual harassment of somebody. The idea that you have to prove that the person who's engaged in sexual harassment behaviors should have known that their victim was particularly vulnerable to that behavior.
Not should have known. Your allegation is he should have reviewed the record. He should have familiarized himself with the record.
For the
standard of care.
Which means nothing unless it's for the purpose of showing that he should have known that she was particularly vulnerable. In other words, it's just an allegation of it. And I would give as an analogy, Your Honor, if you have a car accident case where somebody runs through a red light, and they allege in their complaint that the defendant driver was testing, that they were quieting the children in the back, that they were rubbernecking, and it turns out that you go to trial, and they weren't paying attention, ran the red light. If you go to trial and don't prove that they were texting, that they were quieting the kids, that they were rubbernecking, but they weren't paying attention and ran through the red light, there would still be liability. Likewise, in this case, if the allegations that are taken as true, the doctor engaged in these offensive behavior, sexually harassed his own patient, it doesn't matter whether he knew or should have known that she was particularly vulnerable to that. He's accountable for that. And that's why I think it's a little bit of a red herring to take those allegations, which are really more pertinent to the potential infliction of emotional stress claim, and append them and make it into this two-pronged claim that we have, that we have to prove both of these prongs in order to succeed.
Justice McClanahan has a question for you.
I know the trial court didn't rule on this, but what about an expert witness for causation?
The causation issue, I think it is something I do want to talk about. Let's see if I can do this as quickly as possible. I think there's the pertinent case is the, let's see, it's the Nichols versus Kaiser Foundation. And in this case, what we have that I think fits within that case is we have, and it's a little bit ironic for the defendants to be arguing that we must prove causation, since they treated Ms. Summers over a 17-month period of time, saw her 11 times and prescribed treatments for serious harms, physical harms that were done to her, medically treated those.
Well, but she had pre-existing conditions, too.
Sorry?
She had pre-existing conditions.
She did. And this is
and problems not related to the doctor.
The summary judgment record, though, indicated that as a result of this doctor's harassment of her, she suffered physical pain, increased from her fibromyalgia. She had
right.
Well,
so is your position you don't need an expert witness?
We don't need an expert. It falls under Nichols because we have her own treating doctors who treated her for very similar conditions for very similar conduct. And we have her own testimony and those that were familiar with her with respect to her condition before and after the harassment by Dr. Siptak. And there are a litany of different conditions that are listed there that she suffered from, including attempting to take her own life.
Okay. All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Powell Leach with LeClaire Ryan. I'm counsel for the appellees. As an initial matter, with respect to the statute that was referenced by counsel for the appellant, it's my first notice of that statute as well. Our position would be...
Your first notice is this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
During argument?
Yes, Your Honor. My position would be... That's been waived, Your Honor. You can't fault Judge Wilson either for failing to take into consideration, even assuming the applicability of the statute. You can't fault Judge Wilson for failing to consider that which was not presented to him.
Or briefed before us.
Your Honor? Or briefed before you. And on a fundamental level, I believe there's a difference between conduct and speech. This case is about speech. This case is about words that were stated by a physician during examination of and treatment of a patient. And one of the seven visits we're talking about, the husband was present as well. And for that visit, we're fortunate enough that we have an audio tape that was secretly made by the plaintiff. So we know precisely what was said. This case is about speech. It's not about contact. There's no allegation.
Can I switch gears for a minute and ask you, why isn't the right answer that the allegation of actual notice survives expert testimony? Because if the doctor actually, in fact, knew all the detailed information about her past that was alleged, then you don't need an expert to tell you that the doctor breached a reasonable duty of care to the patient. But the should-have-known analysis, which the trial court ruled upon, you would need an expert for that, because that requires knowledge as to whether or not this kind of physician in this kind of setting for this particular kind of treatment and examination would prudently go back and research all the background on unrelated matters. That would mean a partial victory on appeal, but it would also mean it goes back to trial on actual notice. Why isn't that the right answer to this case?
I think to some degree, well, first of all, I guess my initial answer would be, Your Honor, that's not an assignment of error that this court chose to grant. We're here specifically that the one assignment of error which Your Honors chose to hear was whether or not expert testimony was required for the words that were actually spoken and without the knowledge requirement, Your Honor. And I think the judge mooted, if you'll permit me, in the judge's ruling with respect to the actual assignment of error, the judge's own words were, and this is from page 293 of the appendix, whether the standard of care for medical treatment of a patient disallows the types of comments at issue in this case, regardless of the defendant's knowledge, is a question requiring expert testimony.
Yeah, but I wonder if that's right. I mean, why would you need an expert to tell you, if you're a doctor, if you read everything that's in the complaint about the background of the patient, every one of those facts, not half, but all of them, why would you need an expert to tell you that you should not be touching on vulnerabilities like that, even with this kind of speech, and that doing so would breach the standard of care? Wouldn't that be an ordinary jury question without the need of experts?
I would use the Judge Wilson's own words, Your Honor, to respond with the utmost respect to your question, and that is the language used by Dr. Siptak may be within the common knowledge and experience of the jury in judging politeness or discretion. However, this does not translate into a common knowledge of the standard of care for medical treatment. To elaborate, Your Honor,
it does or doesn't depending on what he knew about the patient. If I'm a psychiatrist and I know that the patient is on the edge of suicide and I make some stupid joke about suicide and it happens, do we need an expert to say that was a breach of the standard of care? Now, if I'm a dentist and I'm filling a tooth and I have no idea about a pre-existing condition with suicide vulnerabilities and I make a stupid comment about suicide or some joke I read in the paper this morning, I would expect there need to be evidence presented by an expert to suggest that the dentist should have gone back and found out about those vulnerabilities and thus should have known not to make such stupid remarks. Isn't that the difference between actual knowledge and should have known knowledge?
I admit there is a difference, Your Honor. But again, I have to keep bringing this back to the actual assignment, though, and according to the judge, even if the doctor knew, let's assume that he did. Let's assume for the purpose of your question that Dr. Siptak knew everything in this patient's history that was in the chart, that he had had time to review the entire chart before he laid eyes on Ms. Summers. And so that was his knowledge base, 100%. Even if that's the case, whether or not it's appropriate to use the language that is alleged, that's not something that a layperson
knows. Why wouldn't a layperson know that? It's the same type of conduct that you would put before a jury in any type of sexual harassment case. The same type of statements, the same type of conduct. And we don't say you need an expert to come in and say, I understand this is Med-Mal, so it's not quite an apropos analogy, but why would you need an expert to come in and say these statements, regardless of what he knew about her background, were more than just bad conduct?
You take my answer away from me, Justice Powell. The answer is that this is, the context is everything. The context is these were words that were spoken between a physician and a patient while the physician was attempting to establish a rapport, a relationship with a patient he didn't know, he'd never seen before. This was all process. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Am I correct? There's two layers to this. One is records and knowledge of the records, actual versus this should have, and there's a standard of care component there. So that's issue one. Issue two is what you characterize as the bedside manner point, which is in the doctor-patient relationship, back and forth, even casual conversation, that is subject to a separate standard of care and perhaps expert testimony, and we need and the court addressed both.
That's precisely it.
All right. So I just want to make sure I'm tracking the...
You are, and okay. You're expressing yourself better than I am, Your Honor. I'm grateful for that. The door closes to the examination room, and the world, it's a different environment.
Because the court addressed both, two parallel tracks, one whether you should have or actually did know about the record, the second whether, regardless of what you knew, whether these statements cross the line.
That's the one before the court, yes.
And that's the one before the court. Yes, I want to get back to your Manchester Oaks argument in your brief, because is this truly a Manchester Oaks problem where it's not as if you have two alternative rulings dovetailing into one answer. You have two separate tracks. And so if the court is correct, you need an expert to say he should have been aware of the record. Does that then do away with his argument, but I don't need an expert for the jury to listen to this and say whatever he knew, this was beyond the pale?
I think the tracks would parallel, Your Honor. I think that Manchester Oaks is opposite. The judge based his decision on these two component ideas, one of which was the Manchester, the knowledge aspect, the other, standing alone, was the expression of the words themselves, whether a reasonable prudent physician would use words like that with his patient. And that's our issue. And my English major is showing, I guess, we're talking about speech. We're talking about what a physician says to a patient clearly in the context of providing care to the patient. And the record is replete with examples of that they would go from a subject of banter into health care. After meeting the plaintiff's husband in the context of a discussion of weight loss and sleep apnea, then came banter about Dr. Siptak and his own marriage. That's Appendix 193 through 212. After initial joking, Dr. Siptak engages the plaintiff and her husband in a clinical discussion about plaintiff's ultrasound, her blood tests, the possible need for a liver biopsy, which leads into a discussion of cooking and diet, and a joke about whether maybe she's trying to kill her husband. We're going back and forth into areas of banter, areas of treatment, areas of care, and we're talking about the physician-patient. We're talking about a relationship so important that a privilege that's been acknowledged for hundreds of years has sprung out of it. We're talking about we're talking about what a doctor may or may not say to a patient in the course of attempting to provide treatment to that patient. And that is beyond what
How complicated is it? You shouldn't say something to a patient with a pre-existing medical or psychological predisposition that puts them at physical harm or risk. And you shouldn't say something to that patient, even though you're treating them for something completely different from that, if you know about that, and you know that you could say something that would actually inflame that predisposition and actually cause the patient harm. I'm struggling with the fundamental question, why would I need an expert for that? I would just say, no, you can't do that. Now, that may not mean you win. The plaintiff wins. You've got to prove causation, you've got to prove damages, you've got to prove a lot of things. But on the first question is, does that breach a duty of care? And I was on a jury, I think we're sure it does. Why does an expert need, what is an expert going to say other than, no, in medical school we never had a subject taught on this issue?
No, with respect, I don't believe that's what the expert that we designated, whose designation is in the record, was prepared to say. He was prepared to say that it is a communication with your parent, with your patient, is very fluid, and things that may not seem, things that may seem tangential or not helpful or irrelevant are an avenue to establishing better communication, and communication is a two-way street.
That presupposes you don't know of the unique propensities of the patient or predispositions of the patient in front of you, because obviously you wouldn't do that if you knew with a suicide patient, for example, you wouldn't make jokes about suicide in an effort to develop a rapport.
I would concede your Honor is correct that with a suicidal patient, perhaps you don't need, but that's not anywhere alleged in this case. That's nowhere in the record, Your Honor.
But he has alleged actual knowledge of a host of facts, which seems arguably plausible, but would take a lot of proof that hadn't been presented, at least at this stage of the case. But he's alleged it, actual knowledge.
Well, Your Honor, I can allege that the grass is green or pigs fly, and it's a true statement, but it doesn't mean pigs fly. I don't think if the judge is bound by that, then the summary judgment doesn't exist in Virginia anymore.
No, if the allegation is he had actual knowledge of facts X, Y, Z, etc., and you can't, at summary judgment, say there's no reasonable, genuine issue of material fact as to X, Y, Z, etc., then he goes to trial, and we find out at trial whether a jury believes that pigs fly. And it's not his burden to prove his facts.
Well, dude, I'm not
at summary judgment.
I understand, Your Honor. Again, I would bring us back to the to why we are here, and that is the third assignment of error, which was the quality of the word.
Can I stop you for a second? Just because I want to get to a point where if a doctor knows there's a pre-existing condition that a person has, and the question is whether or not what he said to this person exacerbated the condition, I thought it was your position. You need an expert to determine that.
That's why I was hoping to get.
Yeah, because, you know, say for instance, somebody says, well, if somebody's suicidal, you don't mention suicide when they come before the doctor. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that the modality of treatment might be. You need to tell them, talking about killing yourself is silly. Let me tell you why. I don't know. I mean, so it seems like to me you need an expert to tell you, even if you have knowledge of someone's pre-existing condition, whether what the doctor did was a violation of the standard of care in doing that to or saying that to this person.
The plaintiff, and this was an alternate ground on which we believe the court can affirm, that is the lack of expert testimony on the issue of causation. You need a physician to establish causation. John versus M, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I could finish my response to your
finish
question.
Finish the answer to his question.
I beg your pardon?
Finish the answer to his question.
Thank you, Your Honor. When you've got a patient with pre-existing conditions, as Your Honor has pointed out, how a lay jury can determine the degree to which a pre-existing, I think Judge McClanahan mentioned this earlier, how a lay person can make the determination as to, well, your emotional state was X for these comments. As a result, your physical condition has degenerated.
See, you're going a step further because you're talking about causation.
Yes, sir.
And what I'm talking about is breach of standard of care by saying a specific thing to a specific patient. So the question I'm asking you is whether or not you think there would need to be an expert to explain or to say whether or not saying certain things to a person that you know has a certain pre-existing condition would be a violation of the standard of care.
I think that dovetails into the other reason.
And you're talking about causation. I'm just talking about violating the standard of care.
I believe Your Honor is correct. I think an expert is necessary for that.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.